Hello, this is Vidas Pinkevičius, and welcome to the home study course of Choral Prelude by Johann Sebastian Bach, Wachet auf ruft uns die Stimme, BWV number 645, from the famous Schubler's collection. In this course I will teach you how to play, master and perform and be ready for public performance, this wonderful choral prelude. And before we do that, before I'll teach you all the steps that are necessary, make sure you are referring to the practice score that is provided with this home study course. Practice score with complete fingering written in and complete pedaling written in. Alright, so make sure you are looking right now in the score. Open the score and follow along the score as I'm teaching you. Okay, so let's start. Very first thing you have to do before practicing any organ composition, and specifically this choral prelude, is to analyze the structure of the composition of the Wachet auf ruft uns die Stimme. This is a magnificent, wonderful choral prelude, very suitable for any public performance that you like, for your friends or family, for example, or church service, especially for Advent or Christmas. This is a wonderful piece, and listeners love to hear this piece in your recitals. If you plan to play it during your recitals, it's across the board on any occasion. You will also enjoy practicing it, I'm sure. This is number one from this collection, Schubler's collection, from the six choral preludes in this collection. And I can say this is the most popular choral prelude from this collection, for sure, the most frequently played. Alright, so let's take a look at your score, practice score, and let's now start analyzing the piece, start looking at the structure, and we will know how the piece is put together in just a minute. So very first thing you have to do when you analyze the piece is to notate the tonal plan, perhaps in your practice score, with the pencil. Take your pencil and we'll see how the piece is put together in just a second. Okay, very first thing you see next to the next to the treble clef and next to the bass clef is of course three flats, and that indicates that this is the key of either E flat major or C minor, because this is a system of circular fifths, and system of circular fifths is a system where the keys are arranged in ascending or descending number of accidentals. So, for example, the key with no sharps or flats would be C major, and then, for example, the key with one flat we would need to go one fifth below C. Okay, that perfect fifth, that's F major. Then two flats would be another fifth down from F, that's B flat major. And then another fifth down from B flat, that's E flat major. So that's three flats. Okay, but also there is another key with the same number of accidentals, the minor key. Minor keys also are found, but not from C, but from A, because A minor has no accidentals. So if we need to look for flat keys, so we'll look from A minor and going down the circle of fifths. Zero accidentals is A minor, then down a perfect fifth from A is is of course D minor, that's one flat. Then another perfect fifth down from D is G minor, that's two flats. And then of course from G minor another perfect fifth down, that's C minor with three flats. So again, as I told you, this is either the piece in E flat major or in C minor. Okay, the easiest thing to decide whether it's a minor piece or a major piece, just to look at the last chord, last measure. Okay, open the fourth page of this practice score right now, and you see the last note in the bass is E flat, and in the right hand part is of course also E flat, and that's a sign of basically E flat major, because really we can very seldom basically the piece might end not on the first scale degree but on the third scale degree. E flat major is the first scale degree E flat note of E flat major, so yes, first scale degree, the tonic note basically. We have to finish on the tonic note, so that's why we call this key E flat major, okay, not C minor. This is a major key, and it has three accidentals, three flats. All right, so now we know the general key, the starting key, which is very important before we analyze the tonal plan, because if we don't know the starting key, how are we going to notate other keys which are used? Yes, so basically there are many other keys used in this in the course of the piece, because of course you see it would be quite boring to play a four or 5 minute piece which is 5 minutes long in just E flat major without any excursions in, without any modulations into any other keys. All right, and Bach of course knew that, and we'll see in the score many instances of different other key areas as we go along. So let's start. The letter A starts in E flat major, yes, and the sign of any new key of course is the either different number of accidentals, for example not three flats but additional, for example flat or something like A natural which would leave like two flats, right? Or for minor keys would be raised seventh scale degree, for example a sharp note, for example that's the sign of harmonic minor. Yes, so we'll look for these new accidentals as we go along, but not all accidentals are the signs of the new key. Basically sometimes they are just plain chromaticism which do not modulate to other keys. They just the signs of this you see this new this old key, but they are chromaticism. We'll meet those too. Alright, so the first line is plain E flat major. Alright, and this section A we can call in an interesting term called ritornello. Ritornello in Italian, this is a term describing the melody or the section that is repeated throughout the piece, sort of like in the rondo. If you know the rondo form, so refrain in French rondo form is this recurring melody refrain, but in Italian it's called ritornello. Ritornello. And the first, of course, this page is ritornello, without the cantus firmus, without the chorale tune, which is later on employed in the left-hand part in the tenor voice. And in the original notation, this voice was written in the tenor clef. It's a version of C clef, where the clef is put on the fourth line. So I make it very easy for you. I just transcribe this piece using the treble clef and the bass, the just modern notation, okay? And of course, fingering and pedaling. In original, in Bach's day, this was written using the tenor clef for the left-hand part, and which starts, of course, on letter B, on measure 13. So ritornello is 12 measures long. It's a beautiful melody which ends and starts, which starts in E flat major, but ends not in E flat major. You see, in this ritornello, we can find in measure 7 an interesting new accidental in the right-hand part, A natural, and that's the sign that it might be a new key, okay? Not chromaticism, but a new key. Let's look at measure 8 also, A natural in the right-hand part and in the pedals. Okay, the next, the measure 9 in the pedals and in the right hand, also the same. So we sort of can conclude that it's a new key, the new key of two flats, B flat and E flat, but no A flat. So using the circle of fifths, we can go now from E flat major, okay, that's three flats, and now up a perfect fifth, up a perfect fifth. By the way, a perfect fifth, if you don't know it exactly, is an interval which is equal of 5 scale degrees. For example, from C to G, C, D, E, F, G. Yes, that's 5. But it also has to have 3.5 whole tones, okay? Three whole tones and 1/2 steps. Three steps and 1/2 step. So from C to F sharp is exactly three whole tones, and then from F sharp to G is 1/2 step. So that's the sign of perfect fifth. So going back from E flat major up a perfect fifth, we will find a new key of B flat major. And that's what happens starting from measure 7. Bach modulates to the new key of B flat major. And B flat, if we think about E flat, our home key, right? The main key area, if we think of E flat, B flat is 1/5 above the tonic, the main note, the main scale degree, the first scale degree. So the first scale degree would be E flat, the second would be F, the third would be G, the fourth would be A flat, and the fifth would be B flat. So in musical theory, this fifth scale degree and the area and the chord based on this scale degree is called the dominant. The dominant. And the dominant, basically, this B flat major is the dominant key of E flat major. So it's related, it's very closely related. It only has the difference of one flat, two flats and three flats. So now, so the Bachen moves, makes the first modulation to the dominant key. Okay, so you can mark in measure 7 with pencil B flat major, in parentheses, the dominant if you want. Okay, what happens next? The ending of this ritornello is also in the B flat major. In measure 12 is a cadence in B flat major, ending on the B flat note, the third beat of this measure. By the way, the meter of this piece is of course common meter C, which is mean that in each measure there are four quarter notes per measure, and the first and the third are stronger beats, right, and the second and the fourth are weaker beats. And the reason I'm telling you this is that when you play it, when you practice this piece, we will have to also feel the strong and weak beats very, very clearly. But we'll come to that in due time. Now let's talk about the first entrance of the tune, chorale tune, in measure 13, letter B. Okay. Although the ritornello ends in B flat major, in the dominant key, Bach is of course returning to the home key of A flat major, because the tune, the chorale tune, Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme, is of course in E flat major, the first three pitches, E flat, G and B, in starting from measure 13 in the left hand part, are the first, third and fifth scale degree of this key. So they are three constant pitches, the main three pitches of E flat major chord, of the tonic chord. So therefore Bach, he had to come back to this key. And the way he do this is of course by adding this extra A flat in the pedal note, in the last pedal note of page 1, you see measure 12, four last notes in the pedal, B flat, C, B flat and A flat. So this A flat is the sign of the home key of E flat major. Okay. So what happens next is of course E flat major area. In the right hand part, you can see this ritornello present there, the either fragments or in full from the ritornello, and it works perfectly well with the left hand part. So basically Bach, when he composed this chorale prelude, actually this wasn't a chorale prelude as it is now. It was a part of the cantata. Cantata number BWV number 140 by the same name, Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. And this is a chorale originally composed for the cantata, where the right hand part is played by the violins together. The bass part is of course played by the string bass and violoncellos and violins and other bass instruments like bassoons, for example in Bach's orchestra. But the middle part, the tenor part, which has the tune originally in this cantata, was given to the tenor voice, to the human voice to sing. Okay, scientists now believe that not the entire choir might have sung these kinds of arias or chorales, but one person per part, okay? So could be one soloist, one tenor singer, but of course it works perfectly well for the choir, for the section of tenors, several tenors combined. All right, so keep in mind that this is not a regular organ piece, but a transcription from the cantata. And of course, besides these three parts, there was a keyboard part present called basso continuo, continuo part, and keyboardist, either organist, most likely organist, would play, or in some instances, harpsichordist. So the keyboardist, at any rate, would play the bass part, plus the chords of this composition, which were notated above the bass line. So he would be providing, he or she would be providing the harmonic support, the chords of this composition. But later on, Bach transcribed this prelude, of course, this chorale from this cantata, and made into a real nice organ trio composition. And that's what we know it today, the Schubler's collection. All six compositions are from the excerpts from the cantatas, arrangements from the arias and chorales from the cantatas. All right, some cantatas are still surviving, and some are lost in the periods of years after Bach's death. So that's kind of unfortunate, but at any rate, this is the history of this chorale. All right, so just keep in mind that this is originally an excerpt, a part from the cantata number 140. Let's continue looking now at the key areas, at the tonal structure, the tonal plan, as we can call it. Okay, now then in measure 17 on page 2, we also see A natural. That's the sign of B flat major, of the dominant key. All right, so we already have A flat major in this piece, then the dominant key in B flat major. Right, so that's the second phrase of the chorale, right, in measure 17, which is of course in the key of B flat major. But later on, after this phrase in measure 19, A flat in the right hand part is also present. So Bach returns to the home key of E flat major very quickly, because you see it's the internal structure of this chorale tune. Some phrases of this chorale are better harmonized in one key than the other. So the first phrase was also very prominently in E flat major, but the second phrase could start and end in the B flat major. So Bach knew that, and he used the dominant key of B flat major. Okay, what happens next? There is the third phrase of the chorale tune in measure 20. In measure 20, we see this return to the home key with three flats. Now the third phrase of the chorale is in the home key of E flat major, and we can see the repeat sign, and we have to repeat this entire section. And the reason that the section is repeated, because in the original chorale tune, not in the cantata but in chorale tune, these three chorale phrases, they have different text. from the second repetition. So if we sing this tune or play, or imagine that singers would play sing the tenor voice, they would use the second version of text, a different text. All right, so this entire section, which is repeated, we can call this section A. In our form, it's not written in the score, but in our mind, we can imagine now the big picture of this score, of this chorale prelude, and imagine that these entire three phrases constitute part A, okay, part A, which is repeated. So A, right? And then what happens next is a longer section B. So the general compositional structure or form or a schematic form we would need to call AAB form. And there is an interesting term for this kind of form. When you see AAB in music, especially in the music which is based on German Lutheran chorales, this is the form called the bar form. Bar, BAR, the bar form. And the bar form was traditional form for the majority of Lutheran chorales. So basically they had A section, which was repeated with different text, and the longer B section. Okay. So remember this, the bar form, this term. And by the way, this section A is in German called Stollen, Stollen, Stollen. And section B is called Abgesang, Abgesang, Abgesang. Stollen and Abgesang, the two main elements of the bar form. Okay, and Bach loved this form, and whenever you see the chorale prelude from based on German Lutheran song or chorale, this is a great chance that you will see this kind of AAB form or the bar form. Okay, so section A or the Stollen ends, and we continue with Abgesang from measure 14. 14 in our practice score, we call it letter C. Okay, so that it's easier to follow the score from sex, so from letter C. All right, so what happens next? Bach uses this ritornello melody, but not from the end, but from the middle of it, okay? But not in the E flat major, but in B flat major, because in the new page 3, now open the page 3, and in 26 measure 26, you see this A natural. So this ritornello also connects two different chorale phrases from the Stollen part and to the Abgesang. Yes, so ritornello is kind of connecting material for these chorale tunes. Okay, that's the main idea. This is how Bach is composing this chorale prelude, not using a through composed form, like he imagines a melody which is a new every time. That's sort of not without repetition, but he takes this ritornello and repeats many times in the middle of this piece, so this piece has a nice rounded form, nice repetitions, recapitulations, and we can hear The listeners really can appreciate the return of the ritornello very well. Okay, so this ritornello ends in measure 31, and in letter D we start the actual Abgesang part of this choral tune. And we see in the bass part A flat in measure 31, which is the sign of course, E flat major now. Okay, let's follow the score. And in measure 35 in the bass line, we see a B natural. And it's interesting. B natural, but at the same time, we can see three flats in the score next to the treble and bass clef. Okay, we find A flat present in measure 36. That means that there are actually three normal flats. Okay, that's the sign of the key with three flats. But this key should not have B natural, this E flat major, right? So this is the sign of a minor key, of modulation to the minor key, which has also three flats, B flat, E flat, and A flat. But at the same time, it has a raised seventh scale degree, B natural. Okay, so that's the sign of harmonic version of the C minor key, harmonic minor mode. Yes, so this is the modulation to C minor. And if we think of the home key now, E flat major, and the first scale degree being the note of E flat. So in relationship to this E flat note C, the home key of this C minor, right? So in relationship to the to our first scale degree E flat, this C note C is sixth scale degree. Alright, so sixth scale degree. We are now modulating to the chord, to the key of the sixth scale degree. Alright, this is a relative minor, as we call it, because it has the same number of accidentals. Alright, and to emphasize the minor mode, composers to emphasize the difference between major and minor. In minor keys, composers usually employ 7th scale degree raised. And sometimes 6th scale degree also. If you look at measure 38, in the right-hand part you see B natural and A natural, which means that also 6th and 7th scale degrees are raised. If both scale degrees are raised, that's not a harmonic minor anymore, but melodic minor. Melodic. Alright. What happens next? On page 4, we have this ritornello, nice ritornello, but not in C minor key anymore, but in G minor, because we can see in measure 40, A natural all over the place, either in the bass or in the right hand part, right? So this is the sign of the key which has two flats, but it's also a minor key because F sharp is present, F sharp, and this is the sign of G minor. G minor in relationship to our home key of E flat major is of course the key of third scale degree. Alright, so this is relative of the dominant. Okay, if the dominant had two flats, now G minor has two flats also. This is relative of the dominant. Relative of the tonic is of course C minor. So we had now the tonic key, it's relative key, then dominant key, and it's relative key. Okay, four closely related keys are already being used in this nice chorale prelude. Let's continue to look at this tonal plan. Okay. In section E on page 4, measure 44, there is nice cadence in G minor, and ritornello fragment ends in G minor. But we come back to our home key, because in this 44, measure 44, you see A flat in the bass, and it's like a beginning ritornello in the right hand part, starting from the pickup to measure 45, starts like the beginning ritornello in E flat measure. So that's the sign of the of the last section, right? Because we are coming back to our home key. We need to come back to our home key sometimes. So that's how Bach returns to E flat major. Okay, and let's see if we have one more key used. Generally, there is one more at the end. Okay, and I'll tell you where it is exactly right now. In measure 52, in the soprano part, you can see this D flat note, which would be the fourth accidental if we count the flats: B flat, E flat, A flat, and D flat. Four accidentals now. So this is the key with four flats, and if we count the perfect fifth downward from our home key E flat, then our new key with four flats is A flat major. Okay, so that's the key with four flats, and because A flat is just four steps away from A flat. Okay, remember, step one, scale degree one is A flat, E flat. Then scale degree number two is F, then G, and A flat. So A flat is fourth scale degree. We call this tonal area and the chord which is built on this scale degree subdominant chord and subdominant key. So A flat major key to the relationship of the E flat home key of E flat major is the subdominant key. Okay, so it's interesting. We have up to now in the entire piece, we already had a tonic key, its relative key C minor, right? Then dominant key B flat major, its relative minor G minor, then subdominant key at the end A flat major, and there is one little instance that we are missing now, the relative of the subdominant, because usually when Bach writes these pieces, he would touch either in length or just very shortly all kinds of different related key areas, and most likely he also uses the relative of the subdominant too. Let's try to find this instant. So the relative of subdominant would be the key of F minor. Okay, it's just a minor third away, downward from A flat major. Okay, or if you think of C minor, okay, which had three flats, then perfect fifth down from C is F minor. That's the minor key with four flats. And it'll tell you exactly where this instance is. Measure 37. Measure 37. We see this F, G, A flat, G, this chorale excerpt, okay, in the left hand part. And in the pedal part, we see this E natural note, which is a leading note, the seventh scale degree of F minor, all right? Because this is then the fragment in F minor. So even though, even at the short period of time, Bach uses all related keys, all closely related keys of this, in this chorale prelude. All right, so now that we know the structure, general tonal plan, okay, and the AAB or the bar form, the next thing we have to know, we have to think about is, of course, the fingering. And since the fingering is provided for you, you don't have to worry about this while practicing. But if this would be a new piece for you, you had to write in fingering. So I written in the fingering for you, and this fingering is based on many historical techniques, many historical traditions, and it helps and facilitates to play with the exact and perfect articulation. Articulation, we will talk about that in just a moment. But this fingering that I have written for you in this score is written in such a way that it provides the ideal articulation. All right. Now, the third step would be to write in pedaling. Again, this step is written in for you, so you don't have to worry about. But look at the score, and there are instances of pedaling where you can see only toes used. All right, so that's the idea for putting writing in the correct fingering for this kind of music, for music composed before the 19th century. In the Renaissance style, in the Baroque style, we typically avoid using heels. I say typically because there are instances, certainly there are, but in general we avoid using heels. Just as with the fingering, we avoid using finger substitutions. Finger substitutions, which means playing one key with one finger and then substituting this finger to another in order to achieve the perfect legato touch, which was used in the Romantic and modern times. So, but in Baroque music, this was not typical. This touch was not typical. We need another articulation, which I talk about in the moment. And of course, we avoid finger substitutions and heels also. Okay, and also when you look at the fingering, you'll see that I kind of try to avoid placing the thumb on the on the sharp keys, on the flat keys, because the thumb is very short in comparison to other fingers, and that was a tradition to avoid the thumb on the sharp keys. But with the piece which has already three flats next to the treble and bass clef, is very exceedingly difficult to completely avoid that. So you see, very often used the thumb on the black keys. So that's kind of Bach modern idea. He used the thumb very frequently because he used all kinds of new keys which were not very often used in music of the composers who lived before him. So he was an inventor, an innovator, basically. All right. So then the next thing to think about before practicing is, of course, figure out the ornamentation. And let's think about the opening ritornello now. All right, the first line doesn't have any ornaments. The second also doesn't have ornaments, but in the third line, has interesting ornaments, three kinds of ornaments. Let's talk about the first instance, okay, in measure 7. In measure 7, we see on the third beat, we see this little 8-note slur to E-flat, little 8-note F-note, basically. This is called appoggiatura. Appoggiatura, and we sort of perform it in the way that we start this ornament on F, but not earlier than the beat, but on the beat. Always start the ornaments of Bach music on the beat. So you have to count out loud the beats and start this this F note on the third beat exactly. That's how it should be performed. That means that the second note, this E flat 16 note, will be shorter. If we perform it very rhythmically and count the subdivisions of this beat, we will see that in this group, F, E flat, D, these two starting pitches, F and E flat, become not 16th notes, but 32nd notes. That's how it should sound. Perform on the beat and make them 30 seconds. The same is in measure 8. Alright, so perform it also as 30 seconds starting on the beat. Alright, so but now a different kind of accidental ornament, excuse me, is before the last note in the right hand part of measure 8. So we have this ornament before before E flat. I suggest you play it also on the beat, but starting not from E flat, but starting from the note which was written before, which is C. So the way you would play this would be C D E flat. It's like three pitches, either C D E as 16th notes, or 30 seconds, perhaps 30 seconds. Right? So then the next pedal, the next ornament is in measure 9, a trill on note D. A trill. In the Bach music, this kind of trill is performed starting on the beat, but not from the main note, but from the upper note. So in this case, starting from E flat. So this would involve E flat, D, E flat, D, four pitches, right? Starting on the beat. Okay, perhaps 30 seconds also. So that's the general idea of this piece, of ornaments in this piece. We have several instances also of trills in the rest of this ritornello, and they are performed in the same way as always performed the trills. All right, so keep in mind when you practice the trills, when you play the trills according to the first ritornello, always they are performed in the same way. All right, so we talked about the form of this piece, that the tonal plan, about fingering, about pedaling. Then ornamentation. Now let's talk about the articulation. Articulation is very important because in the music of Bach, and in general in the Baroque music, the general touch is not legato but articulated legato, which means there are short spaces between each and every note, not too detached, not like too choppy, but connected, quite connected, as in a singable manner, in as Bach calls cantabile manner of playing. But this piece, because it was first an orchestral piece, right, and the right hand part especially was performed by the violins together. In this right hand part, we see many slurs. And this is in original notation. That's not I added, not myself added, but this is written in the score by the composer. So we have to make an exception now and play these notes which have slurs legato. Right? Either we could play them, you know, with complete legato, very perfect legato, or we should make that our listeners would hear these notes legato. That's a big difference, actually. If you play in the smaller room, in your, for example, practice room on your practice organ at home, for example, then I would play all these notes which supposed to be legato, I would play them perfectly legato. For example, in measure 1, the right hand part has 3 notes legato, E flat, F, and G. I would play them legato. But in the larger church, in the larger acoustics, in the larger room with reverberation, the listeners would also need to hear this legato. And if we play the same way in this large room, what happens that the listeners will actually not hear legato, but hear this over legato, over slurring, sort of very unclear sound. So we have to think about to make a little bit of articulation if you ever perform this piece in a larger room, like a cathedral or a church with large reverberation, echo. So listen how the piece sounds downstairs, if your organ is upstairs in the balcony, or out in the room at any rate, how your listeners hear this piece, not how yourself are you're hearing. Okay, you play this legato and this sounds fine, but imagine that you are hearing the echo first, okay? And if you hear the echo perfectly clearly, then the sign that you are articulating well is fine. But if it's too slurred when you hear this echo from the room, then you need to articulate a little bit so that your listeners would hear legato. Okay, that's the general principle. Your listeners should hear these articulations perfectly well, and you have to adjust to different playing conditions on different instruments and in different buildings. Okay, so that's the idea about articulation. Now, let's talk about the tempo. The performance tempo of this piece might range somewhere from 60 beats per minute to 80 beats per minute. Around perhaps 70 is just fine. Even 80 is just fine. I've heard faster performances of this cantata, of this excerpt of the cantata, and it appears that works on the metronome around 80 just fine. But if you have technical difficulties and you struggle to play at that time, at that tempo when you perform this in public, don't worry about that, because 60 would sound just well. The most important thing about the temple here is that your counting of the pulse, your feeling of the pulse has to be present at all times. Whether you are performing or whether you are just practicing this piece, always be aware which beat of the measure you are playing. Okay, not play 1 1 1 1, but count 1 2 3 4 every time you play every measure. 1 2 3 4, 1 2 3 4, 1 2 3 4, etc. And even more important is that you have to sort of subdivide the beats in order to play the rhythm carefully and clearly. You have to subdivide each beat by saying end, by saying the word end. And this end will sound like that: 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. And so this end subdivides your beats into two parts, meaning that you count not in quarter notes but in eighth notes. That's easier to perform if you subdivide the beats. But keep counting out loud as you practice. Okay, that's very, very helpful, because if you count out loud, you are clearly following the feeling of the pulse. You have this pulse in mind, and your piece is not stagnant, not sort of unmoving, but it's moving fluently throughout the time. If you count the beats, count out loud, and you have to also make subtle alternations of strong and weak beats. Remember, we talked about this meter 4-4 having two stronger beats, 1 and 3, and 2 and 4 are weak beats. So when you articulate, we articulate, and when you play these 16ths and 8th notes and quarter notes, always be aware of the beats and count out loud, and think that 1-3 should be stronger, and in our case longer. Sometimes they are longer. That what makes them sound stronger or louder on the organ. So they have to be a little bit longer. And weaker beats might be a little bit shorter. And then they sound softer or weaker, right? So that's the idea about the tempo. Either for the performance or the practice. But it's important also to talk about the practice tempo as well. When you practice, you have to take such a tempo that you avoid making mistakes, okay? Generally, that means this tempo will be much, much, much slower. If your performance tempo will be around 80, I would say 40 is the fastest practice tempo for you. Even 30 is just fine. You see, the slower you start practicing, the slower tempo you take in practice, the more fluent you will become later on, the faster progress you will be making. Okay, so please try to insist on playing slowly. Try to avoid the temptation, resist the temptation to speed up. You will have to speed up later on, but you will feel ready. You will feel ready for the faster tempo. Just, with every day, your piece will get stronger and stronger and stronger. And you will have to, see how you feel about each fragment. And when you perform in a slower tempo, you say, okay, can I play it just a little bit faster and still be in control? Then yes, if you can do that, then you can speed up just a little bit. So day by day, your practice tempo will become just a little bit faster, and eventually you will sort of reach this ideal performance tempo. But even when you know the piece perfectly well, okay, when you are ready to perform it in public, make sure you spend time playing slowly as well. For example, play, for example, 3 times slowly and only 1 time faster. That's better than fast, okay? Because you have to always be in control of your fingering, of your pedaling, of your articulation, ornaments, and things like that, all right? So, what we have covered so far, we have analyzed the piece, we have written, talked about the fingering, pedaling, ornamentation, articulation, the tempo for both practicing and performing. Let's talk about the registration now. Registration. I have written in the suggested registration in for you, which means the right hand part could play with the principle of 8 foot stop, and the left hand part with the sort of a reed stop, either oboe or trumpet of 8 foot, and the bass 16 and 8 foot flutes, right? But when we talk about registration here, look what's written in the first measure. Above the right hand part in Italian is written destra, right? This 8 and fus, destra 8 fus, and then above the left hand part is sinistra 8 fus, and then pedale 16 fus. That's original indication. Basically, composer Bach himself apparently has written these four phrases. Destra means the right hand part. Sinistra means left hand part, and pedale, of course, is the pedal part. So what you see is indication that he wanted to play these three lines on three different divisions. Okay, pedal based on the 16 foot stop. It does not necessarily have to be 16 foot alone, like subbass alone or principal bass alone. It can be with 8 foot also, but when we talk about the actual sounding pitches, we have to now come back to this original scoring of this piece from the cantata. Remember, the right hand part is playing by the violins, then the left hand part is played by is actually sung by the tenors, and the bass part is of course played by the stringed bass and perhaps the other bass instrument like bassoon. So 16 foot is always present in the bass in this case for these cantatas, and therefore we add 16 foot subbass, for example, right? But also it's important to point out that that the violin sound is sort of very, very similar to the principal sound as well. The principal sound. So, therefore, I suggest to use principal 8 foot for the right hand part. And for the left hand part, when the tenors sing, the tenors, you need more sort of solo registration. Therefore, these reed stops, either trumpet or the softer oboe, if you need a little better balance, works really well. Just make sure you try out several registration combinations, several versions For example, try different principles from different manuals. If you have several, see what is more gentle. It's not a very sort of powerful piece. The right hand part should be quite gentle and still vocal, okay? And the left hand part, the reeds should sound also not too powerful. Therefore, I've written either trumpet or oboe, 8 foot. So means that it's sort of like mezzo forte. If the left hand part is sort of mezzo piano, then the left hand part is mezzo forte, and you can even make use of the swell box if present in this division of this reed division. You can adjust the level of volume by closing the swell box perhaps halfway or completely shut this swell box and see how this trumpet or another reed stop sounds. Alright, so that's the general idea for the registration. Sometimes in order for your reeds on modern organs to sound sort of vocal and solid, you need to add an 8 foot flute together. I have not written in this, but make sure you also try out this combination, trumpet and flute or oboe and flute, and see how it sounds. Sometimes it's not necessary, but you have to try still in order to achieve the best results, you see? Alright, so we covered many, many different things now. We have analyzed the form, we have talked about fingerings and pedalings, ornamentation, articulation, tempo, registration now, right? And also, there is one more element to cover, is how to practice this piece, of course. We know a lot about this piece now, because we talked about all these seven different elements which come into the practicing, but we haven't actually covered the practice. So for the best results, I suggest you subdivide this piece into manageable units or fragments, sections, shorter. They don't need to be long. For example, don't practice letter A exclusively for one day, because it's quite a complicated, complex right hand part. So I suggest playing fragments of about 4 measures. I say about, it could be sometimes 2 measures long, 3 measures long, 4 measures, up to 6 measures long if it's easy enough, all right? But the most important thing that you subdivide the piece into these manageable fragments and practice them just exclusively, right? But there is more to this. Don't practice all 3 parts together, because it's like a trio sonata. It's quite difficult composition to play right away, 3 parts, 3 independent lines. So I suggest you play using these 7 combinations. All right, master each combination completely and before going to the next combination. So combination 1 would be, or step 1, let's call them steps. Step 1 would be to play right hand part of this short fragment. Then step 2 would be left hand part. If present, for example, at the beginning there is no present, but in general if you see left hand present, then yes, the second would be left hand part. Step 3 would be the pedal part, so you master these separate voices. Okay. Then number 4 would be right hand part and left hand part combined without the pedals. Okay, mastered it. And number 5 would be right hand part and pedals combined without the left hand part. Six would be left hand part and pedals combined without the right hand part. And only in step 7 we go to the complete three-part texture here and play right, left and pedals combined. So that's the idea of practicing separate voices in voice combinations of two voices and finally three voices. In shorter fragments, repeat these fragments and make sure you completely master each combination by playing them at least three times correctly in the row. When I say correctly, keep in mind correct fingering, correct pedaling, correct notes, correct rhythms, correct articulation, ornaments, okay, hand and feet position, also important that you don't lift the fingers off the keys, but keep them in contact at all times, and also keep your palm sort of in a closed position, so your thumb is almost sort of like, the palm should be in a such position that you are holding an apple, for example, an apple. If you pick up an apple, then this is the ideal hand position. That's the way your hand should be looking when playing. In other words, your fingers should not point to all the different directions. For example, the thumb outwards, the little finger sort of raised and bent and tensed. Okay, everything should be quite relaxed. That's very, very important. And therefore, we play very slowly, practice very slowly. So we should be aware of these techniques, of these elements, and of these hand positions, and stay always in control. Okay? The pedal position, correct feet position, is such that you depress the pedals with the inside of the feet, with the big toe, so to say. If we do that, our knees will be naturally pointed inward, not outward, but inward. And if play that, your pedal technique will be very, very precise. You will be able to better, much easier to find correct keys on the pedals. Also, don't play too far on the keys, too deep on the sharp keys. For example, just place your foot on the edge of sharp keys. When you play natural keys with the pedals, also play them as close to the sharp keys as possible, so that your movements of the feet would be quite economical. You just need to barely move the feet in order to go from the natural to the sharp key and vice versa. Okay. Also, don't lift off the pedal board your feet. Always keep them in touch. Slide from one key to another, basically. Okay? And also, don't use excess force. Don't pound the keys. Don't play forte. Although registration might be sometimes loud, not in this piece, but in other pieces, you can play with large principal chorus with mixtures and even reeds on the pedals, 16-foot trumpets or posaune. Still, your feeling should be quite gentle. The less force you use, the better you will be in control with the pedals. The same is with your fingers, actually, too. Play with as little energy as possible. Just enough energy, enough force to move your finger and depress the key. That's it. The moment you release the key, let your fingers and feet rest and move to the next position. That's called finger preparation and pedal preparation. This is what makes your pedal playing and manual playing automated. You don't have to think about that because you're preparing for the next note in advance. That's a very, very powerful technique, and I suggest you also make use of it. Okay? So we have covered now and the practice element, practice aspect of this piece, how you should practice. Remember, in short fragments and in voice combinations, very slowly, very, very slowly, and try not to advance to the next combination or fragment unless you can play the current one at least three times in a row correctly. That means that if you, for example, play the right hand part, you play the first time correctly, the second time correctly, the third time incorrectly. Okay, sometimes maybe you missed one note or put wrong fingering or incorrect articulation, you mentally took note of this, then you have to go back to the beginning of this fragment and start counting from the beginning, not three, but one, from one. Again, one, two, and three, until you can play this fragment three times in a row correctly. Then you will be very, very certain that you are a master of this fragment, and consequently, eventually, a master of this piece. And by the way, that leads us to the last thing I have to talk about when performing the when practicing this piece, is how to take this piece to the next level. Okay, imagine that in X number of days you learned Y, X, Y, Z, A, B, C number of days you mastered X, Y, Z number of fragments, right? So every day when you learn something new, before learning something new, I suggest you repeat the previously learned material also before. So on day two, for example, you repeat what you learned and practiced yesterday, okay? And only then master something new. Also play your repeated material very slowly. Perhaps try at first all three parts together, and if it doesn't work because it's still quite new and fresh, then go back to practicing voice combinations and even separate voices. But after a few days you will feel that your beginning fragments will sound much, much more secure, much more fluent, much more perfect, if you follow my directions when practicing. And then you can play your repeated material, already material that you already know, three parts together right away, in a slow tempo, of course. Okay, of course. So little by little, four measures at a time, we learn this piece, fragment by fragment, until you reach the end of the chorale prelude, Wachetow, right? What happens next? How do you take this piece to the next level and be ready for the public performance? There is one additional step to take. This is called combining the fragments together. So, in other words, if we learn this piece in four measures, now you can play the entire two fragment part, okay? Combine two fragments at a time, fragment one and two, and then three and four, five and six, and so on. Just play slowly, but without stopping, okay? Then when you reach the end of the piece, then play, for example, four fragments without stopping, then six, then eight, and so on. You double the number of fragments without stopping it, and that what makes your playing very, very fluent at the end. All right, and if you really love this piece, I have this optional step for you, which is called memorization. I highly recommend it because it's a wonderful piece, and you will love it if you can memorize and have this piece in your long-term memory, ready to play for years to come. Yes, so when you see an unfamiliar organ, you don't have your music with you. This is very, very powerful. You can memorize the piece. And there are very specific steps to this in order to memorize this chorale prelude. Also, subdivide the piece into fragments of four measures, but learn one measure at a time. Okay, measure one, measure two, measure three, and measure four. Play five times each measure, looking at the score, and five times without the score. That's how it's done. Okay, and then play measures one, two, without score, then two, three, without the score, and then three, four. That's combination of two measures. Then three measures, one, two, three, and then two, three, four, and then one, two, three, four, combined without the score. That's a very powerful technique. And if you can start and end on the downbeat, that's even better. You have to end on the downbeat of the next measure. That's how these measures and fragments will connect. All right? So that's the memorization part. When you learn four measures, then you, of course, can practice measures 5, 6, 7, and 8. That's also very powerful. This your second fragment. Learn measure by measure, two measures, three measures, and then four measures, and so on, until you reach the entire piece. Okay, until you reach the end of the piece. Then you can also subdivide, make your fragments longer. Okay, play fragment one and two, two and three, three and four, and then one, two, three, four, five, six, and then one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, and so on. You make your fragments longer while playing without the score. Okay, very, very powerful memorization technique. If you want to take this piece even to more complete mastery. And I recommend this step, even if you choose not to play this piece in public from memory. Okay, lots of people still play from the score, and that's perfectly fine. But if you memorize the piece and play from the score, you will feel much more secure. Okay, that's much better, much more secure, because no matter what happens, you know the piece inside out. All right, so if you love this piece, and I hope you do, because it's a magnificent chorale prelude, and you rarely see more beautiful pieces written like that. Of course, many Bach's pieces are like that, but this is especially powerful, especially nice. So take your time to memorize this piece, enjoy your practice, and you will soon discover that you will be ready for public performance, and your listeners, friends or family, church service congregation members, or even your listeners at your recital will enjoy. So thanks for listening, and good luck in your organ practice of this chorale prelude Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme.